Yuki. I thought today, since I got an email from Chris Christian this morning from a place he called Sunny Oslo. I don't know if there is a place, it's Sunny Oslo, but it may be true. But I gather that means that he's not here. So I will use a more relaxed schedule this week. We'll have a break a little later than usual, and we'll just finish when we finish. Okay, so what we want to do is talk about the refutation of that. Yeah?
Can I just mention one? We are still meeting the second class, and it's doing presentations and whatnot.
Okay. I did know that. Okay. So there is a class. Right. Then I have to change my schedule. Okay. So, in that case, I'm going to speak much more quickly.
We can also just get somebody to know it's everything to have that in.
No. Nothing like a deadline to make one focus. Okay, so we ended last time. I gave a short overview of the refutation of idealism. What I want to do now is give a slightly more detailed account of it. And then we'll go on to the third exam. And time permitting, since I've been restrained in the sense of offering criticisms of any doctrine, I may hint at some criticisms. Let's see how it goes. Okay. P275. Conscious of my own existence as determined in time. This is the premise of the argument, and as I said last time, Kant is depending on a distinction here that Descartes fails to draw between the I think, which is formal, logical subject of all judgments, and my empirical self. So when he claims that I am conscious of my own existence as determined in time, he's at least thinking that I have concrete self awareness of my own mental life, and necessarily here we have to imagine at least two moments of it, minimally. That is, I'm aware of having first seen this and then that. And therefore seeing this after that, something like that. So really, some concrete sense of some real bit of my mental history. And And therefore, we're assuming that what I'm aware of is or are datable states. So to begin with, he's already driving a wedge into the Cartesian picture, right? Where he's saying that Descartes failed adequately to distinguish between the I think and the thought of a particular person at a particular time. In order for there to be problematic idealism, the Cartesian ones say that this bit of empirical self-awareness is compatible with it being the case that I do not know whether or not there's an external world. I do not know whether my being in a state is connected to an outside world. That's fundamental, you might say, to Cartesian skepticism. Second step. Is that all right? Second step. All determination of time presupposes something permanent in perception. Since it is only through this permanent that my existence in time can itself be determined. This obviously refers back to the first analogy. But at the moment, he's holding it as a thesis that's weaker than the first analogy. He's simply stating that, in order to be aware of temporal change, I have to see it against the background of something that's unchanging. And this is depending on that much of the first analogy. The question he's going to be interrogating in the rest of the argument is the location or conditions of possibility of that permanence. So he is taking at least that much of the first analogy to be essential, that we can have, if we had nothing but a stream of consciousness and nothing else, right, then we couldn't even be aware of ourselves in that stream. That to be aware of something as a datable state, we have to, as you know, be aware of something that's unchanging. Right? Change only makes sense against the unchanging, hence time is here, the question where it relates to change. Require the background or backdrop thesis as a condition of possibility of awareness of that change. So I can know this occurred and then that occurred because this and that are seen against what hasn't changed. Thus, perception of this permanent is possible only through a thing outside me, and not through the mere representation of a thing outside me. Now, why would you say that? Well, he's assuming a couple of different things. First of all, he's assuming here that all inner intuitions are in a state of flux, as Hume stated. So that even so that the very nature of mental life is of ephemeral and transient items. Time, after all, is the form of inner sense. So our inner life is a kind of indefinite restlessness and constant change. And the elements of it are themselves ephemeral and transient. I suspect he's also thinking, if that's the case, namely that all inner intuitions are in a state of flux, that inner sense has no manifoldness of its own, and I suspect he is inferring from that fact that inner sense has no capacity to generate data of outer sense. So, he also says here that he misstates this. He corrects his statement of it in a footnote at the bottom of the page, which is again from the preface to B, where he says, this permanent, now he's being much clearer, cannot be an intuition in me, for all grounds of determination of my existence, which are to be met with in me, are representations, and as representations themselves require a permanent distinct from them, in relation to which their change and so my existence in time wherein they change, may be determined. Why did he add that clause? Well, I think the thought that he was trying to get there, of course, is there is something unchanging, mainly the I think. But we have no intuition of this I think. So even though this is a permanent structure of thinking, it can't be the background against which I perceive change, because it itself is not an intuition which could be used in that way. So the thought is the restated thought is the deeper one. Namely, there is nothing within my mental life, within inner sense, that could conceivably play the role of the permit. So he says representations can't do it because they are intrinsically ephemeral. Reminds, you know, one thing after another. Think about my words. Try to write them down, even that disappears. What was I writing that? I mean, it goes so quick. So the representations won't do, and the self won't do. So there's a kind of argument by process of elimination here. We agree we need a permanent, as the backdrop thesis requires. We've eliminated representations themselves. We've eliminated the I. So Kant goes on to argue. This perception of this permanent is possible only through a thing outside me, not through a mere representation of a thing outside me. And consequently, because representations, again, are ephemeral, and consequently, the determination of my existence in time is possible only through the existence of actual things which I perceive outside me. Now, consciousness of my existence in time is necessarily bound up with consciousness of the condition of the possibility of this time determination, and it is therefore necessarily bound up with the existence of things outside me as the condition of time determination. In other words, the consciousness of my existence is at the same time an immediate consciousness of the existence of things outside me. Okay, well, that's a strong claim. How might we try to push it through? Well, in part, I think Kant thinks he's entitled to it, as I've just suggested, simply by a process of elimination. If the permanent can't be found within me, then it must be found outside me. Not merely represented outside me, but actually so. Well, as stated, this appears open to a kind of obvious objection. Why isn't it sufficient that I have a representation of something outside me, conceive of it so, but that the actual experience of something and not the actual experience of something outside me? I mean, why? What's the extra existential oomph in this argument? How does Kant avoid the obvious fact that the Cartesian skeptic is going to say, as Kant was himself aware in the preface, in the footnote at B40 DXL, where he's worried about this. That the Cartesian skeptic will happily think of this as what? Compatible with the dream doubt, the evil demon doubt. That's what the whole thing was about. That I had this strong sense of things outside me and I was wrong. So at B277, I'll come back to the preface in a second, he says, in that long footnote at the bottom of the page, over, he says, it is clear, however, that in order even to imagine, now worry about this problem, in order even to imagine something as outer, that is to present it to sense in intuition, we must already have an outer sense, we must thereby immediately distinguish the mere receptivity of an outer intuition from the spontaneity which characterizes every act of imagination. For should we merely be imagining an outer sense, the faculty of intuition, which is to be determined by the faculty of the imagination, would itself be annulled. Well, that's right. It would be annulled. That's what Descartes worried about. So that can't be an answer. I take it that the footnote in the preface tries a slightly more complicated move. BXL. But through inner experience, I am conscious of my existence in time. Now that's an interesting premise, because he's now claiming that I don't really have a bit of self-knowledge, but what my self-knowledge is of is something existential. Namely, I am aware of myself as having a temporal existence, and therefore is myself being in temporally disparate states. Consequently, also of its determinability in time is also the fact that my inner life is nothing but something that is to be temporally determined. And this is more than to be conscious merely of my representation. Now he's trying to get out of, let's call it, the representational veil, representational circle. It is identical with the empirical consciousness of my existence, which is determinable. So he's now claiming, look, the question is, I'm not merely aware of a seeming state of first one thing and then another. This is an awareness of my being a temporal being who is in these diverse states. And I'm conscious of that, so that I'm conscious of myself is my consciousness of my existence as temporal, not simply my knowledge of my existence as temporal, which is determinable only through relation to something which, while bound up with my existence, is outside me. The consciousness of my existence in time is bound up in the way of identity with the consciousness of a relation to something outside me, and is therefore experience, not invention, sense, not imagination, which inseparably connects this outside something with my inner sense. So the argument, as I hear it, runs something like this. That my self-knowledge is knowledge of something existing and its temporal states. And at least with respect to me, I am aware of me, which I take it again is something that the Cartesian won't want to reject. But then the Cartesian cannot doubt the reality of whatever can be shown to be a necessary condition of the possibility of this experience, but in the second step we already saw that the determination of time, and therefore the determination of the existence of anything in time, presupposes the perception of something permanent, and that permanent must be spatial. Well, what Kant is beginning to try to get to here, or let me say what I think Kant's driving intuition is, and then what I think he needs in order to follow through on it. Let's begin, and I think this is why this argument gets so clotted. Begin with what I call Kant's holism. Kant's holism, remember, is that we do not build up our knowledge of outer things by first having private representations. Right? Rather, my claim was, our original and immediate awareness is of things outside us, and that our awareness of inner things is a either change of focus with respect to our awareness of the world. So rather than seeing the bright orange sweatshirt, hard to keep my eyes off of it, I think about my experience of seeing the orange sweatshirt. But clearly, and this is Kant's, my version of his holism, is my experience of the orange sweatshirt is parasitic on seeing the object in space. So that inner space for Kant are only ever, anyway, right, shadows of external acts of awareness. Now, what he's done here, what he's trying to do here, is reconstruct that argument, as it were, from the inside. And the struggle he's having, of course, is since the argument goes outside in, to reconstruct it out, inside out, ends up always, as it were, being weaker than he wants it to be. So he needs some sense of an extra sense of how he can show that the permanent must be really spatial. And after he finished writing the critique, he began to think that the way to cash out this argument was through a fuller conceptualization of the role of the body in ordinary perception. I've said from the get-go that to say I see the bottle is to make a judgment that an object out there from a perspective. from here, right? So my argument is that the I think, right? My whole argument of the I think is, it's not a separate awareness, it's the acknowledgement of the perspectival character of all judgments. So now, what's the cash value of the here? What is the here from which I see the bottom? I can only see the bottle from here if I am located in the same space as the bottle is. But a necessary condition for me to be located in the same space as the bottle is for me to be of a kind with the bottle, namely to be a body in space. So a necessary condition for the possibility of seeing an object from here is that I be a body in space and therefore of a time with the body. So Kant says, and just to, these are all notes from his reflections, in 1788, just at the very moment he finished writing the second edition, he drew the conclusion that since time cannot be externally perceived in things insofar as it is only a determination of inner sense, so we can determine ourselves in time only insofar as we stand in relation to outer things and consider ourselves therein. That is, consider ourselves to be in the same space as them. Or, as he got bolder about this in 1790, he writes, all this, the passages are in Guire, pages 313 through 14. In 1790, he says, we are first object of our outer sense to ourselves, for otherwise we could not perceive our place in the world. Let me repeat that one. I think that's really the crux here. We are first object of outer sense to ourselves, otherwise we could not perceive our place in the world and thus intuit ourselves in relation to outer things. So in order for me to have a relation to outer things at all, the very premise now we're thinking about termination of my existence in time, I must be aware of myself as outer, that is, have an outer intuition of me, and that's the condition of my perceiving them as outside me. Otherwise, the outside me has no... I mean, outside me has to be, we know, outside my own mind. And where is that exactly? In a different space than I am. That is, unless the mind is synonymous in some way with the body, it could not have an awareness of spatial location. So Kant, getting this thought right now, this is the thought he has to get a hold of, It's called, the question is, where the hell is the mind or the soul? And the answer is going to be wherever the goddamn body is and nowhere else. So the soul as object of inner sense, the soul as object of inner sense, this is where we just started, the premise of the refutation, cannot perceive its place within the body. Where's my soul in my body? How am I supposed to do that? Right? But but is my soul is in the place where the person, the mensch, is. So that Kant ends up defending the thesis, which as a teacher he had read in Baumgarten and read it over and over again, and God only knows what it meant in Baumgarten. Baumgarten says quite beautifully and eloquently, the human soul is the faculty of representation which represents the world according to the situation of its body. Isn't that great? If I had written that, I could have retired. The human soul is the faculty of representation which represents the world according to the situation of the human body. So the missing kind of set of arguments in the refutation is that to be in a spatial relationship to an object requires spatial location, and there can be no spatial location unless oneself is spatial and therefore embodied. Therefore, now the argument will run, I guess, namely, awareness of my existence in time is dependent on my awareness of the permanent. Where's the permanent? It's, well, it's at least wherever I am as an embodied self. So that thought put the body back in, so to speak, and now the holism thesis is perfectly in order, because now it really does make sense that we have no awareness of our inner states except as shadows, limitations, and privations of our awareness the world. That I take it is Kant's argument. Joe, you look unhappy.
I'm just not ready to accept yet that that's all, the, all we have in our awareness is shadows and privations. It sort of seems to be pretty thin and unsatisfactory description, at least of my inner sense, but maybe I'm special somehow.
My question is, I can understand the soul must also be in such a in the place in the same place as my representation, and but. I just can understand what's the skip then from the location of my soul to the location of my body, because soul and the body,
the question is the other way around. Give me an idea where your soul could be other than where your body is.
The soul
back in Paris? I mean, what
are people, is it justified to ask such a question? Because so, can it be said in the space? Yeah.
But no, that's the point is soul can only get hold of itself via space. Right? So the argument, which is really going on right throughout the analogies, is no temporal awareness without spatial awareness. Right? No inner without a dependence on the outer. So all of these are permutations on, let's call it, the derivativeness of inner life. That is the thought. And that inner life is something we develop and refine. On the whole, it's probably pretty unpleasant, I find. Took a Ambien the other night, had terrible hallucinations. Terrible stuff. Who wants an inner life? I'd rather look at the world. That's why I live in museums. But that's the thought, that the inner life is a certain refinement of our encounter, learning to encounter and cope with the things of the world. And not a building out. It's not that there's no inner life, it's that the inner life comes from a certain withdrawal from and making use of the materials gathered from outer existence. Now, it is interesting, I only note, it is interesting that at this point in time, that having given where Kant started, that he should end up with such a strong version of our dependency on the outer. And it should also give us a sense, which I've been again pressing all along, that by empirical realism, Kant means realism. He really does mean things and not mere representations. Okay, so I said that not only does Kant begin developing this elaborate structure of the dependency of the inner on the outer, and indeed the primacy of the outer over the inner, which is remarkable given where we started from, the nature of the Copernican turn. But I also suggested that he has a strong sense of the idea of the knower as agent, and therefore that it is essential to the whole of the Copernican turn that there be a strong defense of human agency. And indeed, this was the problem, the original problem with which Kant's critical project began. Namely, it began with the awareness that the unrestricted generality of Newtonian physics entailed two intolerable conclusions. First, if Newtonian physics is unrestrictedly true, then there is no freedom in the world. Determinism prevails. Secondly, if Newtonian physics is unrestrictedly true, then it cannot make any sense of truth, and therefore of science. Science, after all, is a human rational practice. It's a representation of the world. And therefore, in order to have an account of science, you need something more than the content of science. So let's say that the scientific worldview eliminates something fundamental. Science itself as a human and rational practice.
So, Newtonian physics on its own made both morality and science, truth, and indeed empirical inquiry, unintelligible.
It's therefore not surprising that the second half of the book, where he deals with the antinomies, he also deals with scientific rationality as a project. Now, to say all this is certainly to say that Kant, against Locke, never thought of philosophy as a mere underlaborer to science. That simply is being in the wrong relationship to science. To think that philosophy ought to map its results onto the results of scientific inquiry, make scientific inquiry itself all but unintelligible. And programs in naturalized epistemology show how baleful, I think, that idea is. So, Kant's general strategy in the Critique of Pure Reason, the idea of limiting knowledge in order to make room for faith, where faith means not faith in God, but faith in freedom, his general strategy is to demonstrate non-skeptically that scientific rationality does not have an unrestricted scope. It is, as I've been saying from week one, a mode of encounter. An anthropocentric or anthropomorphic conditioned mode of taking up the world. Hence, the fundamentals of the scientific worldview, causality, explanation, falsifiability, mathematics, and the role of the reduction of the qualitative to the quantitative, the primacy of system, all the things that make up scientific inquiry are human contributions to the knowing situation. The goodness of science, and this is what Kant saw that these other characters didn't see. The question was not whether science is how we confound it, it's how do we account for the goodness of science as a mode of our relating to the world. Of course, Kant's view is that all the fundamental ingredients of science come from us. Now, I'm going to say in a moment that this general strategy is more or less right, that's why I've been kind of arguing all semester, but nonetheless I think slightly flawed, and hence I'm going to argue that Kant does require some corrections. But what do we mean by unrestricted generality? I said, you know, the problem with Newtonian physics is it's unrestricted generality. What's the philosophical word for unrestricted generality? It's transcendental realism. That's unrestricted generality. So the antinomy between determinism and freedom derives not from Newtonian physics, but from a philosophical thesis, namely transcendental realism. scientism, that's what transcendental realism is, and not science, is going to be the problem. Transcendental realism, at least as I'm using it in this context, I've been using it all semester, involves two claims. What appears in space and time is what exists independently of us, and vice versa, namely what exists independently of us, exists by itself in space and time, or to say the same thing in another way, appearances and things in themselves are identical. Secondly, things in themselves exist if and only if the sufficient conditions for them to exist are satisfied. I mean by that, if you think appearances are things in themselves, just what's there, then you've got to think that whatever is necessary for that thing to be there in that state with those characteristics, etc., etc., all those conditions are satisfied fully. There can be, as it were, nothing gappy about things in themselves. There can be no indeterminacy. So let's put this as a third point. Things in themselves must be fully determinate with respect to every possible pair of predicates, A and not A. That is, for every possible pair of predicates, you have to be able to determinately say whether or not it holds of that object. And hence, absolutely fundamental for the argument of the Antinomies, appearances must be, for the transcendental realist, fully determined. Because appearances are identical with things in themselves. Okay, that's the background. So I'm going to claim that the whole thing, I mean, why do I think this is the way to start? Because if Kant's going to solve the antinomy by saying transcendental idealism, then it helps if the problem is transcendental realism. So what I'm going to have to do is give an interpretation of both the thesis and the antithesis of the third antinomy, by which the contradiction between them arises if and only if, right, both of them are interpreted in a transcendentally realistic manner. You're okay with that? Yeah. So here it's that we're going to have the thesis and the antithesis, and we're going to give them each, in order to generate the contradiction, a certain realist interpretation, and then we'll solve the antinomy by interpreting them from the point of view of transcendental idealism. That's the general strategy here for the third attempt. Okay, the thesis asserts. Everyone happy with where we are? I know I'm rattling away here. You're all familiar with this stuff, aren't you? It would be nice Wednesday afternoon, 7 o'clock in the evening, rather. Solve the problem of freedom. So the thesis of the third antinomy states causality. I'm just going to read it. Causality, according to the laws of nature, is not the only causality
from which appearances of the world can one and all be derived. To explain these appearances, it is necessary to assume that there is another causality, namely that of freedom. So the thesis is going to assert that appearances require freedom, since causality, in accordance with the laws of nature, is insufficient to fully account for appearances. Now, kind of strikingly, both thesis and antithesis deploy reductio ad absurdum forms of argumentation in which you assume the opposite of what you want to claim and demonstrate its impossibility, its absurdity, as reductio ad absurdum. Take the opposing view and show its absurdity, therefore leaving your original thesis in place. Well, as you can kind of easily guess just by looking at the thesis, right? Natural causality is insufficient, it requires freedom. This is going to be take the form of a very standard infinite regress argument, right? So the argument runs, just to do it broadly, starts with the idea, and here I'm just going to follow Watkins' outline of this. Broadly, assume the opposite. Assume there is no freedom, and that all causality occurs in accordance with the laws of nature. If all causality occurs in accordance with the laws of nature, then for every event that happens, there must be a previous event from which it follows in accordance with the laws of nature. Simple enough. Hence, if the state from which an event follows in accordance with the laws of nature, if such a event had existed forever, then it could not have brought forth the event that is supposed to follow in accordance with the laws of nature. That is, there's got to be change in order to, a condition requires a previous condition and not an unchanging state, because only some change can bring about change. Something has to change to account for change. That's all he's arguing there. Hence, for any event that happens, the state from which it follows in accordance with laws of nature must itself be an event. Change only is going to come from previous change. Conditions from previous conditions. Now we can get our infinite regress going pretty easily, I think. Right? If every event presupposes a preceding event from which it follows in accordance with the laws of nature, then there is never an absolutely first causal event, and thus no completeness of the series of events on the side of the causes descending from one another. That is, simply, if events only follow from events, and there is no first event, then we just have to keep going back and back and back and back forever. There's no completeness. And then there's therefore no completeness of causes for any event, because every event is conditioned by the previous events, and there's this infinite regress going on, so the conditions for any event never take place. Therefore, if there is no completeness of causes for an event, then an event happens, and I'm quoting now 8446, an event happens without a cause sufficiently determined a priori. That is, what Kant means now is, if you're actually having infinite regress, then you're imagining that an event happens without the conditions for an event happening. That's why it's a regress argument. Hence, since we know the opposite to be true, namely every event happens if you imagine that, now you're imagining an impossible world. Namely, you're imagining a world in which every event happens without a cause sufficient to determine it. And we know that's false. We know no event happens without a cause sufficient to determine it a priori. Therefore, the original premise is false. Namely, there now must be a kind of causality distinct from causality in accordance with the laws of nature, that is, one that occurs without its cause being determined by another previous cause. And then it says, A446, an absolute causal spontaneity beginning from itself. So the heavyweight clauses in this argument concern the idea that there can be no completeness of causes and no event happening without a sufficient reason. Those are, I take it, the real working clauses. And those clauses, I'm claiming, simply are theses of transcendental realism. That is simply the principle of sufficient reason and the principle of determinacy. That if an event happens, all the conditions for it must be satisfied. And an infinite regress leaves them unsatisfied. Hence, what's involved here in getting this argument going is simply very, very strong readings of the principle of sufficient reason. That appearances, and I mean strong, I mean this, appearances are fully real and thus completely determinate entities. That's really what the argument depends on. Think of it another way. If a cause, this is what the background of the argument is, if a cause is to be a sufficient reason for its effect, then there must be a sufficient reason for it as well. Now clearly, this form of transcendental realism assumes a rationalist version of realism in which the world is fully determinate a priori. I'll state it and then we'll have a break while you get your minds back. The antithesis simply asserts that there is no freedom in the world, since freedom is incompatible with the requirements of a natural world, and therefore freedom is only, I'm quoting, an empty thought thing, A445.
Okay,
so how is he going to run the argument? For no freedom, that is for causal determinism, and he begins, reductio, suppose there is freedom. If there is freedom, and there's a spontaneous, uncaused event in the world, an absolute beginning in a series of events. Step two, if a series of events is caused by